You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. I just say now Google us rather than rattle off all the places we are, because if you just Google us, you'll see that pretty much social media-wise, we're everywhere from Twitter to YouTube to our Facebook to iTunes, etc. So just take a look at the results you get. And remember that Wellington Square Bookshop was voted best bookshop in the Philadelphia area, as well as the best coffee shop. So stop by. Seriously. And it wasn't just me voting. So today on the show, we're really pleased to have with us Abigail Thomas, whose continuing memoirs are the subject of her latest work, which is What Comes Next and How to Like It. Her previous life stories are chronicled in part in Safekeeping, Some True Stories from a Life, and in A Three Dog Life. Abigail is also a great painter, which I didn't know till I looked at her website, and she paints with illegal oils on glass, which is fine for you because they're really cool paintings, and if you go to the website, you can buy safe 100% rag paper versions at abigailthomas.net at what I consider really reasonable prices, and they're really cool. It's like, we'll talk a little bit about it, but anyway, Abigail is getting older. She talks about it a lot, as am I, and you out there. And in addition to remembrances about her husband and his tragic accident and what it does to him, did to him and to Abigail, the book candidly details a life that has its ups and downs for sure, but are told in a really candid manner and in such a way as to allow us to open up a little ourselves, either on paper or to friends or just inside. It's kind of a naked book, and those are the ones that not only take courage to write, but although they may embarrass and put one at ill ease at times, they kind of wipe away the paint, if you will, that usually lets us look through a glass only darkly. So, Abigail, thank you so much for being alive and for being here.
That's the nicest introduction I've ever had. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, at the very beginning of the book, one thing that kind of got me at the beginning, I wasn't sure, was where Chuck tells you to make up the book. So, did you make up any of it, or is this
exactly? Oh, no. Okay. I never make up anything in memory.
And I'm not saying you did. I'm just, he does say that, like, in the first couple of pages.
He does. I think after I began to write it, his memoir, he began to wish it was awful. But that was not going to happen. I don't make up anything. I have a very bad memory, except for what I remember. And what I remember are, like, those moments where it's like a blow to your solar plexus, or you can't stop laughing, or it's terrifying or sad or something, which is the only way I could write this.
Well, I read it, you know, I read it and I read it very closely and I loved it, but it's been out less than 2 months, so before I start blabbing, which is what I will do, since most of our readers haven't had a chance to read it, and maybe your previous books, just give us a little rundown before I ask you questions that I'm interested in. Give our listeners a little bit of a rundown about why you wrote it. That's a good start, why you wrote it.
All right, well, it started out as a book about a friendship that had been very close for a long time, mine with my friend Chuck, and that had a hole blown through it when I found out, and I was told by Chuck, that he had had an affair with my youngest daughter. And that sort of blew a hole through everything. And it was really, really hard to write. And sort of at the end of what I was able to put together, my daughter got cancer, a particularly terrifying kind of cancer, triple negative breast cancer, which, as they say in the brochures you get, is likely to recur. And that became along with Chuck, the other half of the book, that we had managed to make of our friendship that had been blown apart something stronger than we'd had before. And that was what interested me, that we not only did we stay friends, we became better friends. And he was the one who helped me a lot through Catherine's illness. And it was also territory I'd never gone into. I'd never gone into the future, which is, I mean, I just can't even think about the future, or what can happen, or mortality, or any of those things. But those were sort of thrust into my face when my daughter got sick.
It's interesting how your daughter's illness and Chuck's
illness too.
Yeah, Chuck's illness is what starts the book, and how they weave throughout the book, and they return. It's almost like musical in the sense that they return, and then they kind of morph slightly. And,
thank you.
And
thank you for understanding that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You know, it's funny. I was thinking. I'm 63. You're in your 70s. Although your voice sounds like you're in your 30s.
Are you 63? You sound like you're 30.
That's what I was just going to say to you.
And that's because this life is so much fun, actually, and so interesting, even though it's horrifying.
Well, yeah. You know, I was thinking a couple of things, but one is, you know, like if you had a gas tank, and you know, if you had 80 years and you have half a tank, you got 40 left, and then. You know, guys always go, well, I got a quarter tank left when they're driving, and that's 20 years, and then the yellow light comes on, and you know,
God.
Well, I can get this much out of that yellow light. And you do that, so I don't feel embarrassed talking to you about that, because you lay it out on the pages.
You should be writing. That's kind of a perfect metaphor for what happens when you get older.
Yeah, it is, and what happens is you... The thing is, once you live 30 years, you know what it's like to live 30 years, and that's part of the reason why it goes faster and faster and faster.
Well, and it's not even just you've lived 30 years, but your children are 50.
I know.
How did this happen?
Well, my mother's 92, and she always says that I'm older than she is.
Oh, my God.
And I tell her if...
God, how wonderful.
And I say, if I die before you, Mom, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, you really don't want to out. You don't want to.
No, definitely not.
No.
It's funny because, like, when I was younger, my dad and other people would say to me, you know, as long as you have your health. I had no.
Well, and that's true. I know. It's such a cliche.
I know. I didn't know what they were even talking about at the time.
No, I didn't either. Chuck and I went out for lunch the other day, and somebody said, how was your day? And I said, well, Chuck and I went to Shindig and had pancakes, and then we went to CVS and picked up our prescriptions. And I thought, oh, not only how hath the mighty fallen, but there's a whole new intimacy here. Where does it hurt? What do you take? What about your shoulders in bed? What do you take? I mean, Chuck has something more serious than I do. But
yeah, describe that, and because the book obviously took some time to write. I wonder what the progression or amelioration of his situation is at the current time.
Well, the book took a really long time to write. It really took about 7 years before I could figure out how to write the story that people had, and as Chuck had said, please write the story about you and me and my daughter. But when I was finally finished with the best I could do, he said, well, this is only half a book. And then the other half was, as it turned out, Catherine with cancer and mortality and how you face what you're gonna face, whether you like it or not. And you better find a way to like it.
Well, where is everybody now? Where is Chuck? Where is Catherine?
Well, Chuck is, we all live in Woodstock. Catherine lives 6 miles from me. Chuck lives a mile from me. We see each other all the time. We're good friends. Gosh, what else can I say about it? We turned the shambles into something stronger than we would have had before the blow up, because it was a hard thing. It was very hard, because I was, and I loved them both, but what? Who the hell was I? I mean, here was my best friend, in love with my daughter, who was spurning him because she realized this was not a good idea, and you don't know where your loyalties lie. You don't know. It was just, it was tough.
But it's like a lot of your life. I mean, started out, you know, getting kicked out of college because you're pregnant at 18.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like having three kids before you're, what, 26?
Yeah. Boy, you've read this stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think of it. It's so funny because I really think of my life as having been lived in moments, not something that connects. But you could certainly say, here I was, and then this happened, and this happened. But honestly, I really only remember what I remember, which are moments that either hit me hard or made me double over laughing, or you know, or enlightened me in some way. I would never have been enlightened had I not been writing. I do really think that writing is, at least for me, the way to get to the bottom of things and to figure out what you're really feeling instead of what you think you're feeling.
It's funny when you talk about like laughter, and laughter is a big part of your life, and your dogs too, which we'll get to. But like Rich does creep into this book from time to time, and there were two lines in this book that affected me in different ways. The first was kind of wondrous and magical when Rich says, "I think that sparrow just became disconnected from its shadow."
Oh God, yes.
Because it's right. He's right. He's not there.
Wrong.
You know what I mean? I mean, he was right. It's just that he wasn't there, kind of. And then what made me laugh out loud was when you saw a picture of yourself from behind and said it looked like there was
the open umbrella.
looked like there was an open umbrella concealed under your skirt. I even read that to other people and they laughed out loud.
Yes. Oh, well.
I know. Me too.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Yes. Well, I have accepted the universe. It's not as bad as all that, but it's pretty bad. I'm not who I was.
Well, how come
and
you didn't
thank
put...
thank God.
True. And then, like you said, you know, even in that paragraph, you said, you know, okay, I'm done. It's time for other people.
It's somebody else's turn.
Yeah. Well, how come you didn't put pictures in the book of, like, you when you were younger and extremely hot, obviously?
That's very interesting.
What? Okay.
I don't know why we didn't.
Why didn't you?
I don't know. It's a good question. Yeah, we were both of us extremely hot. but it sort of wasn't the point. Because honestly, when I looked at Chuck, I thought, friend. I didn't think, oh my God, would I love to get into that.
I know, and that's the thing. If this was a novel...
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking, why aren't they taking this last step? Especially that one scene, we'll call it a scene, where he leaves, comes back, and you both are saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Do you want to get married? And,
yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, it was. That really was funny. And I've been in situations like that, too. But it's...
It was all it needed to be.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all. I mean, it was all it needed to be. Both our minds were going in the same direction. It was all it needed to be. You don't need to go any further with that.
That's
why
that
you don't need to write horse under the picture of horse. At least that's how I see it. And it was such a pleasurable moment. You know, it was really and that's all. You don't need any more than that, because you know, if you go any further than that, you're going to ruin something that's so precious,
right?
As it is.
And that's why the lunch you had with him was so difficult to imagine and to read, because especially at the end when he goes, it couldn't have been anybody else's daughter but you.
Yeah.
And it's like, you could get really, really pissed off at that.
But
or,
you could also really understand it.
Right, yeah. Because I was ambivalent about it. I felt like kind of hitting him in the face, but at the same time, it makes perfect sense. But he loves you, so, you know?
Yeah, we do. We love each other. That it was, you know, other people have had that reaction. God, I just want to cream him. Because it could so easily have been just a, this is how I'm going to get out of this. But it was also true. It was also partly true, although certainly not entirely. You know, it really, at least I think it was, it made it easier for me.
I can see that, but then...
Admitting. Sorry, what?
I was going to say, but then, you know, like I said earlier, you return to it.
Yeah.
There'll be pages about your dogs, or there'll be pages about painting, and then you return to not that moment necessarily, but how you begin to come to some kind of, not necessarily a reconciliation with Chuck first, but more of a reconciliation with yourself. It kind of surfaces and then goes back down, then comes back up. That was interesting.
With myself and also with my daughter, whom I hadn't realized I was angry with. And if I hadn't written this, which is why I'm such a, I forget what you call it. What do you call it when somebody just trumpets the benefits of something? That's why memoir is so helpful, because you find out things that you really didn't know.
Well, it's like when you recap
about yourself.
When you recap that scene, not scene. I keep thinking scene like this is going to be a movie. Who would play everybody?
I don't know. Chuck has Brad Pitt in mind.
Well, now you'd have to be Meryl Streep, I guess. You have no choice. I think
it's very funny.
I think you've passed the Julia Roberts stage.
I was born past. Julia Roberts stage. I never had a smile that didn't have some irony, unfortunately, attached to
no,
the
I think
back
that's,
of it.
In my life, I think that's a fortunate thing to have attached to your smile.
Well, it makes life more interesting. More difficult, but
yes.
More interesting.
Well, I've always looked at it like, you know, I'd rather be sadder but wiser than, you know, ignorance is bliss. You know,
yes, me too.
I picked it early on. It's been a pain
absolutely.
In the ass.
No, me too.
I mean,
me too. And there are people who just sort of float by.
Well, look at, if you're devoutly Christian and you just have this prime mover, which is faith, what a great life, you know?
It's so much easier, isn't it?
Yes.
But the rest of us have to find the meaning in something that has no meaning whatsoever.
Yeah.
And then make it matter. And make it matter for others who can then get something out of it. I don't know.
For some reason.
Oh, I already love you.
I love you too.
Too bad you're so young.
Yeah, I know. 63. My mother tells me I'm young. It's silly, isn't it? It's just because we're both not, you know, we're just in these receptacles is all it is. You know,
we're
both still kids.
That's certainly true.
For some reason, when we're talking about the spiritual stuff, it reminded me of your dad, because your dad was always one of my heroes, because like I read Lives of a Cell like when I was 13 years old, and
it's a wonderful book, isn't it?
Yeah,
it really changed. Wonderful.
It changed my life, and the Medusa.
I'm so glad to hear that.
And the Medusa and the snail and the youngest science. I mean, I can rattle them off.
Oh, I'm so glad you. I'm so glad, because not everybody remembers him or what he wrote, and my God, he wrote as though his hand scarcely touched the page. He thought and thought, and then he would write it down on a long yellow legal pad, and it was already done.
Yeah,
he was just wonderful. I wish he were here. You know, I really do.
That's like my dad. My dad
what
told
would
me.
You
that,
tell me about your dad.
Well, he was the same kind of person. He said you could run your life and your business with a legal pad and a number two pencil.
Oh, I love him already.
And he was like a royal pain in the butt. He could be a royal pain in the butt, but it took me 20 years of therapy to realize that when he called me a jackass all the time, he was really telling me he loved me.
It takes a while to get that straight.
Yeah.
Still, he shouldn't have called you a jackass.
No, I know. That's why I'm all messed up.
But you don't sound messed up at all. You sound really pretty solid on the ground.
It works well for about an hour. After that, it pretty much.
Do you write?
I write, but here's my problem: is that I do write, but I can't think of a story. I can write exposition and narrative and dialogue, but I don't have a story.
Why do you have to have a story?
I don't know.
Why can't you just have pieces?
You can.
Cover a scene. You don't need a story. The story takes, you get this archipelago of different pieces, and that's the story.
Well, talk about your painting, because that's exactly what your painting is. You know, like,
yeah, the painting is really fun because it, you don't know what you're getting until I paint on glass with house paint, with toxic oil house paint. And I think I know what I'm doing, and then I turn it over to where the painting actually is, and it's nothing. So I scrape it off, or I brush it off, or something, and then I turn it over again, and there's the painting. It's really a question of enhancing the accident, which is exactly what writing is. You start somewhere, you have absolutely no idea where you're going or why you're going there, and then you look at it and you realize, that's what I'm writing about.
And that's what people have said when I've shown them your paintings, especially the idea that you're just doing this, and then all of a sudden there's this whole grove of birch trees.
Yeah,
and where did they come from? Yeah, where did they come from?
Right, that you had no idea you were making. You've got this swamp in Louisiana. You've got this, and that's what's so much fun. It's such a mess, which is what writing is. And then you surprise yourself with what you've got, which is what writing is, too, at least writing memoir. If you don't surprise yourself along the way and certainly dismay yourself, oh, my God, is this really what I thought? Then you're probably not doing it right. But God, it's so much better to bring the dark up to the light than use all the energy you've got to keep it down there.
And it's funny, it's like when you say, a lot of people probably don't get what you say, I only remember what I remember. I've forgotten everything, I just remember what I remember. But it reminds me of that book by Julian Barnes, The Sense of an Ending. It's like, you remember what you remember. That's not what happened.
No, but that's who we are.
Right.
We are what we remember, wrongly or rightly. That's what makes us who we are. You can't go back and excavate out something that didn't happen the way you remember it, because you've lived with that reality your whole life. I had a student once who had who had been told by her mother, who was nuts, that she'd had a twin brother who died at birth. Okay, so 30 years later, at some Thanksgiving party, she found out she'd never had a twin brother who died at birth. How do you go back?
Don't know.
How do you go back? Because how can you not live your life with that guilt and sorrow and loss? That's made her who she is. You can't go back and suddenly turn into somebody else, you know. I remember things so differently, as we all do, from what my sisters remember or what my mother might have remembered.
Yeah, my brother Bob, who's just 20 months younger than me, he'll remember the day that we went to the circus or whatever, and it's all different and all jumbled up. And then my mother, this is both my mother and my father. My mother, whenever I was bad, she would tell me I was adopted. So,
what?
She has this incredible sense of humor. I can make her laugh more than anybody, and she makes me laugh more than anybody, which is what I'll say at her eulogy, because I can't think of having a better relationship than yourself laugh.
Yeah, that's a hard one, though. You must have been adopted.
No, it wasn't must have been. You were adopted.
You were adopted. Ooh, how old were you?
When I was little. On top of that, my name is Sam, and they didn't want a boy. They wanted a girl, and they had already picked Susan, so she would dress me in a dress when I was like 6 months old. So there you go. That's pretty weird.
Oh, my God.
I shouldn't be saying this on the radio. You're supposed to be...
Oh, no, you should. It's very interesting, and I don't think it's that... You know, I think a lot, well, I don't know how unusual this is, but this sounds very hard to get through. Oh, my goodness. Have you written your stuff? You should be writing.
Yeah, I have, but in a lot of authors I've interviewed had said that to me, and it kind of like makes me feel bad. But at the same time, yes, I do, but, and then I think, oh, well, I'm 63 and I've missed all this time. I can't write now.
That's nonsense.
Well, I know. Look at you.
Yeah. Check it out. 73. Come on.
I know. It's
you
amazing.
You can do this. You should do this. This is actually quite interesting.
Okay.
You lived through. I mean, just started a tiny place.
Yeah.
Just started a tiny moment.
I just went to this place called the Tower Theater in Philadelphia this weekend and saw the author Neil Gaiman, who I love.
I love him.
And it was like it was like a rock concert. I mean, there was all these people, and he spoke, read, and talked, and answered questions for an hour and a half. But, you know, the questions were always the usual questions. How do I start writing again if I get stuck in the middle? And how do I start? You know, he just said, sit down and write and just keep writing.
Let's do it.
Get rid of all the horrible stuff until the good stuff starts falling out. And
absolutely. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Don't give up. Don't be afraid of the mess.
No.
Just keep going.
That's pretty much what your book... Well, that is your book. That's
pretty much.
That's the title of your book, for God's sakes.
Don't be afraid of the mess.
Right.
But it took a long time to write. I just...
Well, you know, I have like... Okay, here's what I got. I got a dog, I have three cats, I have two alpacas, five goats, two peacocks, two chickens because they've been eaten by foxes.
My God, where do you live?
I live outside of Philadelphia in a house that was built in 1775.
Is it haunted?
Yeah, it's haunted in a really nice way. It's my most comfortable place I've ever lived. I can go down to the basement at 3 o'clock in the morning. I feel totally comfortable. Every once in a while, I smell someone smoking cigarettes, but nobody smokes cigarettes in the house, so it's kind of...
You have to write about this. Are you in Bucks County?
I'm in Chester County. Oh yeah, you went to Bryn Mawr, right?
Yeah, for about 5 minutes. and then I got kicked out because I was pregnant from a Haverford guy, and we got married and had three more kids, and it was not a great story. That was actually my first memoir. Let's not even talk about it.
You brought it up, not me. Oh, no, I did bring it up. Sorry.
You brought it up. You definitely brought it up. God, that's absolutely fascinating. How long have you lived in this house?
For 14 years. And I lived in Florida before that, actually. But this is where I came from originally. And it's an amazing house. It's a beautiful house, and it's like when you're sitting in front of the fireplace, and it's one of those gigantic fireplaces, you can feel the weight of like six generations before you. Not like in a haunted way.
This is your book. It's so easy.
Yeah, you're right.
Start with every room in the house.
Okay.
Start with the basement. I mean, who goes into a basement at 3 a.m? Not me.
Well, okay. Here's the thing with you and talking about your dogs, which is kind of icky to me, is that
icky?
Yes, because they all sleep with you. They tear apart everything you own. There's got to be slobber all over the place. But you
can't. There's no slobber. They are not slobbering dogs. They are chewing dogs. They are hounds. They like to sleep with me, and God knows I couldn't sleep without them. But they don't slobber. They're perfectly neat.
But they eat everything.
They do. They chew all the upholstery off. But why do I care? So all of my couches have half their upholstery hanging off. Why on earth would I give a
I don't know.
I don't. I wish I did. I just don't. The things that I prize are hanging on the wall or sitting on the mantle. I mean, I've got a lot of wonderful outsider art and...
Pieces
of strange things.
Yeah, but your dog took one of the things that you like, put it outside in the yard, and you had to put it on the mantle in order to keep it safe. So
that's true. That is true. But I did find it in time. I'm not very good at training four-legged creatures. But the thing that's so wonderful about them is not that they love me, because I'm not so sure they love me. I'm the source of a lot of good stuff, but I get to love them. I get to love them with absolutely unconditional, I don't give a what you tear apart, love. And it's so much more complicated with people, where you feel a little guilty. What did I say this morning over breakfast? That's not a dog problem. It's just...
Well, it doesn't sound like you're a cat person, though.
No, I'm so not a cat person. You know why? Because they don't make any noise at night.
Oh, that's interesting.
And something will slither around your ankles before you're conscious. And cats can be, I mean, they're wonderful and they love you and stuff, but they can also be a little aloof. And, you know, dogs really aren't ever aloof. They're just on you.
There's a good New Yorker cartoon where the guy comes home late from work and the dog is sitting there by the door and he goes, where were you? I was worried about you.
Yes, I just, you can be gone for 5 minutes or you could be gone for 4 days and the greeting is the same.
But with cats, the reason I like cats is because it's like, they don't really care. It's like, they come up to you, what can you do for me? What can you do for me now? And then they go away when you do it.
And no, I know, but I have two dogs who are really not lap dogs who sleep on my lap. I think I might not be able quite so much to love cats without any questions. I can love dogs without any questions at all. They let me love them. Cats, you know, they'll up and off themselves in a very different way from a dog. A dog will hop off me because he's just not comfortable, or it's time for him on the couch. But there's never anything that I take personally. I just love the hell out of them.
I've always had Labradors, and I've always named them Putney, because I figure if I ever do get Alzheimer's, the last thing I'll remember is the name of my dog. Because they've all been the same.
Did you go to Putney?
No, but I got him in Putney, Vermont.
Yeah, Putney.
That's where I found him. The first Putney. This is like the fifth one in. I figure you have seven dogs in your life and then you die.
Oh.
I've had six. Sorry.
No, when my favorite dog died.
I remember, in the book.
Yeah, it was, I mean, this is terrible to say, but it was worse than any human death I'd ever gone through.
Really?
Yeah, it was my dog Rosie, and she would just look at you and say, I know you better than anyone, and we both know it. And no human being, had he or she ever said that, would I have believed. But I believed Rosie. You're mine and I'm yours.
That's really interesting that you feel that way.
Oh, I do. I do feel that way. I don't feel that she hears me the way I sometimes think my father might hear me when I'm talking to him. I don't think Rosie really hears me. Rosie, my darling girl, I don't think she hears me. But I do think sometimes my father is sitting next to me on a bench for whatever one makes of this.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
But the loss of that dog who, God, just saw through me and claimed me, that was a really serious loss. That was a serious loss.
Well, you know how your dogs, at least some of them, are kind of selective about what they chew up?
Yes.
Well, Putney, the first Putney, I was interested in reading stuff like back when I was in my teens, early 20s, about the occult. I read the Satanic Verses by Anton LaVey. And I read a lot of things, you know, in Paradise Lost and stuff like that. And Putney, who must have been like an Irish Catholic retriever, at night he would get up and go to my library and only take out the books that dealt with the devil or satanic things and chew them up.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And no one believes me, but it's the truth.
Oh, no, I totally believe you. Oh, that's really interesting. Oh, my God.
I suppose I could write that down.
Oh, please. No, and don't even think of the words narrative arc. Just scratch them out. Just these moments. That's fascinating that Putney chose just those books.
I'm really...
That's really, really interesting.
Well, I really feel flattered because talk a little bit about what you teach and, you know, about teaching people how to write.
Well, you can't teach anybody
how to
write.
That's true. You can't.
You can encourage what's working, and you can say, you know, on page two, you go off to the right, but maybe it would be better to go off to the left where you had started and just simply stopped. You know, if somebody writes a paragraph that doesn't work at all, you either have to make the paragraph go away or you have to lift it up and see what's underneath, because it's either nothing or there's something you're afraid of saying. And that's, I think everybody has a story in them.
I agree. I like the way you said, you say to a student, it might be better. I guess you've learned not to say should. You should.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. I think people do so much better when you make it an interesting problem.
Right.
You know, instead of saying this doesn't work, just say, wow, you know, what if you blah, 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 kick this door open, open this window. And it works so much better. You don't want to ever say, as somebody once said at Tin House, I remember somebody once telling me that a teacher of memoir said to the class before it even began, none of you has anything worthy of a book-length project. And I thought, oh, what are you doing teaching?
Oh, I got a better one than that. Maybe this is why I don't write. When I was in humanities at the University of Florida, and William Goldhurst was my professor. His father was Harry Golden, who wrote a book called The Lost Generation. But anyway, and Harry Cruz was also one of my professors. But the guy who wrote Edisto, Paget Powell. But I went to his office after class, and I go, well, how do you become a writer? I was only 18. And he goes, if you have to ask that question, you'll never be one.
Oh.
And what a horrible thing to say to a kid.
What a stupid, arrogant.
Yes, he was. He got kicked out.
Okay, so we know that now.
Yes.
That was a stupid, arrogant thing to say, and you were a young man, and now it's time to write these moments.
Okay.
Write these moments, not some horrible narrative arc. Write the moments.
Okay.
Of which you've said quite a few.
Thank you.
It's easier, and I remember when I wrote Safekeeping, which I had no idea I was writing, I thought of them as, I wanted to call it short controlled bursts, because I had heard that that was the way you shot at targets or people. And I thought, okay, I want to write this moment. If I hit it, I don't need to write what was else happening. You know, I don't need to put anything in there except the moment. You don't have to say what trees were around it or who was lying on the ground or what you'd had for breakfast. You just get the moment, and then you move on. It's
yeah.
not so hard.
No, a perfect example of how one of those moments in your book, and the moments in your book are pivotal moments. Like, for example, when Catherine comes to your house with the kids,
yeah.
you're all excited, but you kind of act kind of pissy. And,
yeah.
and, you know, she says, okay, Mom, I think we're going to leave now. You're yelling. She says, I think we're just going to leave. And then you realize
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And then you reconcile. And you reconcile because you finally communicate, which is the most...
Yeah, because you finally realize you're angry.
Yeah.
Because you don't... And there's no way I would have known that had I not written it. There's just no way. If you write it, there's kind of no escape. That was a really terrible, terrifying moment. Are you going to leave before I get back? Are we not going to be able to?
Oh yeah, that's right. You had an appointment. A friend was visiting.
Yeah, no, there was somebody already on her way, 100 miles away to have lunch, and I couldn't. I had to do this. But that's what's so helpful about writing. You there's no way you can let yourself off the hook. You know what? This is happening. This is terrifying. This means something. You have to write about it. You have to absorb it. You have to...
Well, you know, I don't mean to be complimentary, although I love the book, but it's like, it does take an enormous amount of courage, and it is kind of naked for you to do what you've been doing for all these years, and lots of other memoir writers just decide they'll just, you know, smooth it all out. You don't smooth it out.
Well, if you're smoothing it out, you're not writing memoir.
No.
Memoir is often deeply upsetting. You know, you find out things about yourself you'd so much rather not know.
Well, since you've written memoir and written about memoir, like, so why don't you, like, for our audience, since you and I are just having a chat, So why don't you explain, what is the difference between memoir in your mind and, say, autobiography?
Well, autobiography always feels to me like a resume. And memoir is what you remember. And memory is... what we remember has made us who we are. You know, I don't have much of a resume, but what I remember, I remember. And
well, it's kind of like Proust, who sometimes, when I think of remembrance of things past, I think, you know, basically it's like people now who videotape half their life and then they watch it in the second half, rather than...
Oh my God, how wonderful and awful.
I know, and that's what sometimes I think about him. You know, he's writing about these Madelines, but he's... I don't know. I have mixed feelings about what that work is. It's like, if you're constantly documenting your life, when do you actually live it?
When do you live it? That's a question I've asked myself, too, because I have a daughter who pretty much documents everything. She's living it. But it does interrupt it, you know? Wait, stay like that. I just don't know. I mean, I suppose if we're writing memoir and something's happening, we scribble it down while it's happening. But to document it is something completely different.
Well, it's like when I went to the Vatican, and everyone's outside taking pictures of the Vatican. But you could buy a postcard that has a picture of the Vatican.
Yeah.
You
might as well go in and
look.
Feel it.
Yes. Or, you know, I think maybe you even said it, or somebody said it recently to me, is just look up, and nobody looks up anymore.
What is the difference between the people who... What is the difference between the people who take the picture and look at nothing, or and the rest of us who look up? Who allow our... What are the rest of them scared of or not used to?
Because they go to a party. This is why I get kicked out of parties and why I don't have any friends. And maybe maybe you too. Is because I don't want to talk about golf. I don't want to talk about mutual funds. I don't want to do that.
Oh, my God, no.
But everyone, that's what they talk about. And
where do you live?
It's a very affluent kind of area, a very high socioeconomic demographic. And I don't mean to be condemning people, but it's just the things they, like I said, you and I are kind of like kids. And so it's really hard to play with grown-ups at Thanksgiving.
Well, you know what? They're not grown-ups and they're boring.
And
mutual funds. Good God.
Yeah.
I don't even know what a mutual fund is. I mean, I suppose I should.
Well, I do, unfortunately, whatever I invest in. I should call you up and tell you what I'm buying so that you can sell it.
No, because I wouldn't know. I wouldn't understand. I wouldn't...
You don't have to.
Right, just
that's
do
the cool
what I
thing.
Say.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting.
But it's... the thing about looking up, especially now, because the metaphor is perfect, because when you go out to... Oh, this is the saddest thing. Is when you go to a restaurant out to dinner and there's a family of mother and father.
And they're all watching their things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
that is the saddest thing. That, in fact, that makes me furious.
Yeah,
that makes me furious, every single one of you. You know, you go to the Grand Canyon and every single person is looking at their... So what has gone wrong?
It's not even only that. They have to go on Facebook or whatever and tell somebody what they're doing at that moment. Like, I have a friend, he's a pilot, and he takes a picture of like a sunset while he's landing somewhere, and he puts sunset over whatever, and I'm coming in for a deposition. And I go, okay, Mark, I saw a sunset. I've seen sunsets. I know. Good. I'm glad you saw a sunset tonight.
It's really boring, though, to see. It's not news.
No.
So explain to me what has gone wrong, because this is going to go wrong for a long time. This generation that needs to put... I had oatmeal for breakfast.
Well, I know.
Who cares?
I'm here. What they want to say is, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here now. And but you and I sound like our parents, what they thought of us. And I try to keep that in mind all the time, because it's just going to get worse And owning an independent bookstore is a perfect example, you know? I mean, I buy books.
Do you?
Yeah, yeah.
What's the name of it?
It's Wellington Square Bookshop, and I want you to come and visit.
I want to. Where is it, though?
It's just in, well, you went to Bryn Mawr, so that's on Route 30. You just keep going out Route 30 and make a right at 100, and we're right there. It's easy. It's 20 minutes from where you got kicked out of school.
Yeah, I would love to do that. But I'm interested in your saying, I'm here. Well, what is the need to say?
Well, it's you said, they're scared. They're scared that they might not exist. It's like, don't you know people that, like, talk because they can't stand the idea of there being a vacuum in time?
Where, yes. Unfortunately.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And I think it's like that, only modernized.
Okay, so it's whatever they power, they pronounce it, or vacui, fear of the void. But who were we before we had all these ways of saying, I'm here?
Well, you talk, your book a little bit touches that, because you're talking about, you know, and again, I'm not, I feel fine talking about this because you talk about it. So it's not like I'm invading your privacy, but mm-hmm. you're talking about death and mortality a lot, especially towards the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you're really scared of it, but then it's like you're not really scared of it. So why don't you explain that a little bit better? Are you scared of it?
There's not much point in spending your time worrying about it.
But are you scared of it?
Am I scared of oblivion? I honestly don't know. You know, I don't want my kids, who are all pretty close to me, to have to deal with life without me, but that's very selfish, and it means that once I'm dead, they will probably begin to come into their own. Am I scared of it? I'm scared of coming back. I don't really want to come back.
You said that in the book.
I think I've had enough, unless I can come back as something that crawls or slithers or climbs. I don't think I want to come back as a human being. This has been, I think I've had enough of this.
Yeah, I think there's something in your brain as you get older, almost like endorphins when you have pain, that softens or eases the idea of mortality. That,
yeah. What could be more boring than immortality?
Really?
Can you think of anything more boring than forever sitting around whatever you'd be sitting? I have 12 grandchildren, and two of them, twins, live about 6 miles away, and they were over here one day, and we were talking about, what do we think happens after we die? And they said, both of them, quite... they believe that, well, we come back as something else. And then my grandson, Augie, said, but first I want 30 years where I just eat peppermint stick ice cream and play Lego. And that sounded like such a reasonable way to deal with immortality. After a while, you just get 30 years of doing what you want to do. Immortality just, it's that scarce out of me much more than mortality does. What about you?
I'll ponder a second like you did. I don't think I'm afraid of dying, and I know what you're saying about your kids and grandkids, and I have kids and grandkids too, and I know they'll miss me, and I would say I'll miss them, but I won't know that I'm missing them because I won't be around.
That's right.
But they'll miss me for a while, and then everything will be fine. I know that too. So, you know, it's like you. I've had my mother and my sense of humor is really warped, because I'll go over to her house and she'll yell at me or something, and I'll say, you know, Mom, why don't you just cash in your chips now? I mean, not much more is going to happen. I mean, you're going to be 93, so, like, I mean, what's the point? You know, I've been waiting for your money for 30 years, you know, like, so. But she laughs, I laugh, and it's just, I think, that's the other thing, I think. As long as you laugh at death, it's...
You do definitely need to laugh.
I think death has a much harder time getting to you if you keep laughing at it. It feels bad. You make it feel bad.
You do. Oh, well, good. I would like to make it feel bad.
Yeah. I think that's reasonable.
And you know, once you're dead, you're not afraid of dying anymore. You're dead. You're it's over unless you get to fertilize the woods or your garden or something. And gosh, I guess I haven't really, I've kind of pushed this out of my head.
Well,
because whatever's going to happen is going to happen. There's absolutely nothing. I mean, I'm 73. I'll be dead in
whatever.
I'm not going to last another 5 years. I smoke a pack a day.
Yeah, you smoke Camels too, don't you?
I did, but now I smoke the organic way to die. now I smoke American Spirits.
What's it's so funny. It's so funny. I keep interrupting you. I'm sorry I do that. It's just that I think of things I want to tell you so you can listen to them. when you go to New York now, you see all these kids rolling cigarettes and you think they're rolling joints, but it's because a pack of cigarettes in New York now costs $13.
Yeah, that's true. I went on a book tour down south and they were $6.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't want to buy a whole bunch of them because then I'm committed. This way I can think, well, maybe tomorrow I won't buy a pack of cigarettes. But you know what? It's so much fun to smoke. I really love to smoke, and there's so few things I can do now.
Well, they're like your friends.
They are. They're 20 little friends. They're 20 little friends. The fact that they're trying to kill you is upsetting, but I don't think of that very much.
We'll talk about.
I love to smoke, and I also love to drink.
That's what I was going to say. I don't feel bad because you talk about it, but why do you talk? You know, you say, I don't think you are, but you say you're an alcoholic, kind of.
Well, I'm the kind of drinker who, once she starts drinking, keeps on drinking. Of course, I'm an alcoholic. I think there's so many differences. I mean, so many different ways of defining an alcoholic. I don't drink all the time. I'm not drunk in the morning, but once I've had a drink, there is no such thing as one drink, you know? There's just, you get to that lovely dappled place, and then you don't stop. But you know what? I'm 73. I'm having a good time. I love my kids. I love my friends.
And you have your dogs.
And I love my dogs. So kind of, although I know I can't say this on the radio, but kind of, it, you know?
Okay, I got to put down. This is at 5203, so we can beep this out. And stop saying that, because I have to beep out like 20 words already. I'm writing all these down, and the engineer's going to get mad at me when he comes back in.
How many kids do you have?
I have Michael's 35, Katie's 32, Samantha and Annie we adopted from China. Samantha's almost 18, and Annie is 13.
Yeah, that's just lovely.
And two grandkids. But,
oh my God, that's so nice.
I know.
Are they nearby?
Everybody's. I tell my mom how lucky she is because all three of her boys, her grandson, five grandsons, and great granddaughter are all within 10 minutes of her house.
Oh, she is lucky.
I know, right?
Oh, she's so lucky. As long as she doesn't have to babysit.
She won't. When the first one was born, she said, my first child was born, she says, I'm never babysitting.
No, that's really true. You want to see them when you want to see them,
right.
And then you want to go home. She's my kind of woman.
You and she would definitely get along.
Although I do adore them. I really adore them. But when I'm ready to go, I'm really kind of ready to go back to my very quiet house with three badly behaved dogs. Because solitude is really important. But God, the grandchildren are wonderful.
Well, let's do this because I got to get going because we talked for 53 minutes, 34 seconds.
Okay.
But what I was going to say was, I have a feeling, we have tons of book clubs and we have our own too. So I have a feeling your book will be picked. Well, I'll try to have it picked as a book club pick. And then you can.
I'll come.
Yeah, you can come. That would be great.
And, I would love to.
Okay. And then I can always talk to Catherine, your publicist, or call you back and we can schedule something. That would be great.
I would really love to do that. Thank you. And I can probably even find my way to Philadelphia.
Yeah. Even though you were only here for 5 minutes. I mean,
right, just about five, maybe six.
Okay, what was it?
Time enough.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Abigail.
Oh,
I really enjoyed
too.
It.
Me too. You have to start writing.
Okay, I will.
And just little bits.
All right, I will. Jeez.
Nothing big.
All right.
Little bits.
Okay.
Oh, it was lovely to talk to you.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon then.
Okay, thank
Bye.
You.
So, me acting like a fool again, that was Abigail Thomas, who's the daughter of Lewis Thomas, who's a great writer. She's good, too. But he was a great science writer, and I love science. So anyway, let's see. So what do we have? Coming up, she was hilarious and really nice. And she's a great writer, and she's also a great writing teacher, especially of memoir. So next we have, I think next week will be Judith Claire Mitchell, who wrote A Reunion of Ghosts, and then J.C. Holman, who wrote Be and Me, A Story of True Literary Arousal, which sounds kind of sexual, but it's not. It's about the way he loves the author Nicholson Baker. And Nicholson Baker wrote a book called You and I about his friendship and adoration of John Updike. And then Laura Dave, who wrote this book called 800 Grapes, which I think is about wine. Sounds like it is. And Courtney Maum, who wrote a book called I'm Having So Much Fun Here Without You, which many people could say that about me. I'm not quite sure what that one's about because I haven't read it yet. So in any event, for a complete schedule of all this, you can visit us at our website, wellingtonsquarebooks.com. Like I said, Google us. It'll all be there. Or just go to iTunes. You don't even have to type podcast. Just type in, you know, Abigail Thomas or the name of her book, What Comes Next and How to Like It, or just type in The Avid Reader, and you'll come across us. So I think I've used up all my time, as usual, talking. And thank you so much for joining us today. I thank Abigail Thomas, our guest, who wrote What Comes Next and How to Like It, a memoir of her, the third stage of her life, kind of. And we will talk again next week, as always.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.